Missing this?
When that didn't materialise, I think both Paulie and myself probably looked at each other and kind of thought, what next?
Then get this, the all-new OTB Sports app. Off the Ball, Ireland's premier sports channel, now has a new home, featuring the biggest names in Irish and world sports. Podcasts, interviews, news, commentary, analysis, plus almost 20 years of sporting archives. All free and ready when you are, at home or on the go. The new OTB Sports app. Download it now from the App Store and Google Play.
The OTB Podcast Network with Virgin Media. Catch all of the UEFA Champions League and Europa League games live on Virgin Media TV.
The Sunday Papers on Off the Ball.
Now you're very welcome back. So we're going to chat through some of the Sunday papers. We have Brendan O'Brien with us from the Irish Examiner. We have Cliona O'Connor as well, part of the Dublin hurling coaching setup and an All-Ireland winning footballer in her playing days as well. Guys, thanks very much as ever for being with us.
Hi, Joe.
I'll start with some of the headlines then. The Sunday Times are going with Champions League. A lot of the papers are really going with Champions League. It has been the story of the weekend in many ways. Lookout City, it's a picture of Robert Lewandowski, who was in phenomenal form for Bayern Munich last night, and Lionel Messi, who was typically Lionel Messi. Lewandowski and Messi send out warning as Bayern and Barca move into last eight of Champions League. That is the Sunday Times sports section lead. Sun Sport then, we have a picture of, as you can imagine, a dejected looking Frank Lampard and his Chelsea players last night in Munich. Frank is sick in Munich. And then beneath that, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer has been talking to the press ahead of Manchester United's game on Monday evening. Best day of my career, Solskjaer, to win the Europa League as boss will top everything. Also there on the back page of the Sun, Kop plan to hook Brooks. This is Liverpool eyeing a £35 million swoop for the Bournemouth midfielder David Brooks, apparently. And top of the back page in the Sun, brand new day for FAI. This is in a few places. Certainly it would seem that the FAI chairman, Roy Barrett, has not ruled out the possibility of a rebrand, a different name maybe for the FAI, because obviously three letters FAI at the moment are fairly linked to some grim connotations. Sunday Mirror, it's Ole Gunnar Solskjaer again doing his pre-match press conference. Trophy will make United boss so proud, Ole's Eurovision. And over on the right-hand side, it's a picture of Lewandowski there. 4-1 win last night, if you missed it, in Munich. So Chelsea dispatched 7-1 on aggregate against Bayern Munich, who look really good now and have been really good since new manager came into place last November, December territory. Sunday World, 24 hours to Sancho. This is United warned to pay the price by tomorrow or else Jadon Sancho stays at Dortmund to finish out contract, apparently. So negotiations are continuing there. It's hard to know exactly what's going on. Alongside that in the Sunday World, Pat Spillane. Spillane is furious at Neffet for some poor calls. I've never been so angry in all my life, says Pat Spillane. His column is inside. As well as looking at it with my GAA cap on, I was viewing it from the perspective of a father whose daughter's wedding had to be postponed and is now rescheduled for October. And also as a former rural publican, I think Neffet got it wrong on all counts, not allowing 500 to 10 GAA matches, restricting the number of guests attending weddings, regardless of the size of the venue, and not allowing the reopening of rural pubs. That's Pat Spillane's take in Sunday World. Back page of the Mail on Sunday, thrown back. Kildare, Offaly and Laois see fixtures halted for obvious reasons. That's Michael Clifford there. Picture as well of Raheem Sterling, the real deal. Madrid slayed by Sterling, now City can conquer Europe. And beneath that as well, I mean, this is a big story. It's probably gone slightly under the radar the last couple of days. GPA call for July end to inter-county season. We might touch on that in just a moment. And then the Sunday Independent have a picture from the club action over the weekend. Not that you would recognise him with his hurl and his helmet on, but that is Conor Callaghan of Coola being challenged against Nafina in the Dublin Senior Hurling Championship match at Parnell Park yesterday. Nafina came out on top in that game. And beneath that, City on a revenge mission in Europe. This is Mike McGrath writing, and City, the revenge mission aspect is on UEFA and the financial fair play situation. Let's start with that GA back page then, seeing as it is on the lead and the Mail on Sunday. GPA call for July end to inter-county season. This has the potential to be a big story if the GPA drag their heels in this. They obviously have the power to dictate a huge amount if they really want to when it comes to the inter-county season. So it's Michael Clifford here. The GPA is set to push for a six-month inter-county season that will see All-Ireland finals played by July from next year. This is as radical as it gets, really, from next year. The players' body have written to members. They've recommended a radical redrawing of the GAA fixture schedule. They want a split model that would give clubs an unobstructed window between August and December. GPA's already signed up to a report published by the Calendar Fixture Group, which presented three options for reforming the calendar and competition structure, none of which were based on a split season model. However, in the aftermath of this year and COVID and seeing what it's like, the players' body now believe that there is an appetite for a similar structure post-COVID-19, and that's what they're going to go after. Sustainable amateurism, they say, is designed to allow you achieve better balance in your life off and on the pitch. So that is a big turnaround, Brendan O'Brien, if the GPA are now looking for an end to inter-county action July every year and from next year as well.
Yeah, and my initial take on it is that it's so simple, you kind of think, well, why hasn't this been a bigger debate before? I mean, there's a lot of very obvious plus points that can come out of this. I mean, the most obvious one being that you're finally freeing up a significant portion of the year for the club player and for the clubs as well. I mean, the club v county thing has been tearing the GAA apart in one form or another for a long time now. And even the inter-county season itself could do with a more defined structure, I feel. There's a lot of talk in the GAA in recent years, going back a couple of decades, certainly since I've been covering the GAA as a sports reporter, that there's this reluctance to give up an extra chunk of their season, that you're giving over that window frame to, you know, football and rugby and other pastimes as well. But you know, different models, different sports, different countries. But we see in Australia with AFL, we see in America with NFL. I mean, they have much shorter seasons. And if you define that and if you package it properly, and by packaging it properly, you're talking about a proper structure in there as well. We don't want to talk about structures, I'm sure, on a fine Sunday afternoon. But that all has to come into it as well. It's not a magic bullet by just putting it into a framework. Within that framework has to work as well. But you do that, you get suddenly, you can go back to sponsors, you have a better product, not just for your inter-county game, but suddenly you've got your club game. Imagine club players knowing every year, I'm going to be playing club hurling or football in August. You know, it won't just be a case of seeing these fantastic club teams playing in the dead of winter. So a lot of positives on it, I see. But like you touched on, Joe, it's hugely radical. And the nature of the GAA is that we see things happen incrementally. And the former Director General, Padraig Duffy, I always remember chatting to him about that. And he said it on record as well, that's the nature of the beast, and it is a big beast, and it takes a lot of time for this stuff to go through.
Yeah. Brendan, to what extent, though, do we need to be careful about what we're wishing for here, or what we're wishing into existence? Like, so looking across the Sunday papers, there's this brilliant picture of Conor Callaghan here in his helmet playing for Cooley yesterday. And aside from that, there is not a word on all the GAA action which is happening across the country, not a jot. None of the columnists are writing about the club action. You know, the columnists who talk so much about the glory of the club, they're not writing about it. So, you know, imagine a situation where from next year, come July, that is it for the inter-county season. GAA will disappear then from visibility for the next 6 months. I mean, there won't be a jot about GAA in the papers across July, across August, across September, and you're putting the finale of the season, which will still garner attention, but you're putting it up against the finale of the Premier League, the finale of the rugby, to a lesser extent, maybe the finale of the Champions League. So I accept, absolutely, it will be better for the club player who is planning a holiday in August or who wants to know when they can go and when they can't go. It's definitely better from a participation point of view. But you really got to look at what you're giving up here. You know, all the wonderful traditions of summer and GAA and inter-county colour and a build-up to late August as it is now or September. For that just to disappear, like, do we all love the club scene that much? Are we all watching the club scene that much? Have you watched many club games over this summer?
No, I haven't. That's a very fair point. I think when you're looking at the question of balance, if we're all being honest, you know, the viewership numbers for club championship are very, very low, relatively speaking, compared to the inter-county. That's got to be expected. I mean, you know, you're not going to have as many people interested in a club as opposed to a county. It's not got the bells and whistles of the county game. But what you have to ask is the balance right the way it is at the moment? The balance is completely skewed towards the inter-county game. And this goes back to the image of the GAA and how it thinks of itself. It's a club-first organisation. The balance has to swing back in favour of the club at some stage, because it is a crisis point. And everything we've heard from everybody in any position of authority, from players, from inter-county players, they will admit that the club is losing out, that they are losing out by not being with the club. And it goes back to the point I made, one of the points I made earlier, Joe. The framework, that 6 months, is obviously going to stick out with people. We're losing 2 or 3 months from our season here. But that's why I say it's not just that frame. It's what happens within that frame has to be packaged correctly. And I believe, and I think most people would accept that you can frame this better. The structures can be better. We can get more sense on the inter-county season. It can work better. You can get a link between league and championship that can work better. You can give teams defined times when they're playing. You can be an inter-county player and you can look and say, I know 6 or 7 weekends stretching into maybe June where I know I'm going to be playing inter-county GAA. I know come August that my club has this system in front of us. So you will lose something. There's no doubt about it. And there is a step into the unknown. But the balance as it is at the moment just isn't there. It has to be redrawn towards the club scene in some shape or form. There has to be some give and there has to be some take.
Tina, you're at the coalface. You're working with the Dublin Hurlers. You've been a player in your day. Does the idea of a July end to the inter-county season from next year grab you as a good way to go?
It's challenging to know, Joe, what's the best option. I think players, coaches, everyone involved, what we really want all the time, the certainty. It's the uncertainty that's a challenge from preparing teams, from preparing yourself as an athlete. And I think what you articulated there is it's the fear that everybody has right now. The GAA, from a commercial media point of view, all of that, we enjoy most of the year, really. You'll get a little bit of O'Byrne Cup coverage, you'll get league, you'll get provincial championships, then you'll get August, September, All-Ireland final. So you really dominate a huge part of the year. And there is a fear to give that element up. Brendan's point, though, about the clubs and trying to, everyone's saying the balance needs to swing back. But the point is, the clubs, when you're measuring it, success or the right choice, when you're talking, measuring that on a commercial point of view, the clubs don't deliver like inter-county delivers. So it depends on what you're prioritising. From a coach's point of view, the big thing that we want, and as I said, is certainty. I don't, from a coaching perspective, I don't really care whether the season is 6 weeks or 8 weeks or 12 weeks. But once you know, and you know exactly what you're dealing with, and the tidier that is, the better. In various sports, some are long, some are short. It doesn't really matter. You just deal within the parameters of your season, and that's possible.
We've seen there on the back page of the Mail as well, Kildare, Offaly, Laois see fixtures halted. I mentioned Pat Spillane on the back page of the Sunday World, not happy with Neffitt, not happy with the decisions being made. Brendan, you picked out one or two pieces as well. I think Colm O'Rourke is more in the Spillane camp than anything. Eamon Sweeney is a bit more understanding of the situation, I would say, and less critical of Neffitt.
Yeah, I think that sums it up pretty well, Joe. I think when you read any of the pieces at the moment, even in a sporting context alone, you do get the sense that we're all trying to grapple the various different strands in it all, in a sporting context, in a wider context. And it comes across in both those pieces. But I think you sum it up well. Colm O'Rourke is more in one camp. Eamon Sweeney kind of, he can see a bit more sides of the argument. Just a couple of the points that stood out for me from Colm's piece. He was talking about how the GAA was expecting, you know, the bump up in limits inside grounds to 500, and he uses the phrase, it looks like the GAA was sold the pup, and that the NFET and not Cabinet are making the decisions. Now, to me, that kind of overlooks the fact that this is a very fluid situation. You know, it's an obvious one to say, but like I think language like that, I think, kind of simplifies it a bit. He also says at one point the GAA should be left to run its business, and a limit of 500 would still be very safe in big grounds. And I think in both pieces, it makes the point about what's been highlighted is it's not just in the grounds. In fact, it's not in the grounds. You can socially distance with those numbers in any of our big stadiums. It's what happens when you're going to and from grounds. People are stopping off in these motorway service stations. You don't need to be an expert in science to know what's going to happen there. I thought Eamon Sweeney's piece was really interesting. He makes a point one way, and then he makes in the other, and that's in a good way. I hasten that it was, you know, he talks in a very general sense about the meat factories. He talks about we're the only EU country that's letting in American visitors. He basically draws a line through the entire leaving certificate. It's not that important, which I think overlooks the social aspect of schools and getting kids back in. But he does make the point as well that residents of rural Ireland and sports fans should resist the temptation to regard ourselves as uniquely hard done by. And he makes the point of the arts as well, I mean, which is completely crippled by the fact that it's an indoor pastime, and how he would, you know, he would miss seeing things in the Cork Opera House as much as he would in Porky Queeve. So it was a very, I thought it was a very nuanced piece from Eamonn as well. But I think one great line from it that sticks out for me, and you know, we all have questions about how has this decision come to this? How have they arrived at that? Why are we in three counties lockdown? Why is everything happening? And one of the things he says is some of our COVID-19 policies seem to be based on the same kind of principle which prompted the apocryphal drunk to search for his keys under a street lamp. Not because that's where he dropped them, but because that was the only place where there was light to see. So I think that just does sum up, like, we all have questions. Why is this being singled out? Why is that being singled out? But the overall impression of reading any of these articles is we're all, as the headline in Eamonn's piece says, we're all fumbling like a drunk in the dark.
Yeah. Cliona, I got the impression in the Spillane piece and the O'Rourke piece that almost they need to remind themselves how good sport has it at the moment in comparison to a huge number of industries. I mean, 200 to 500 is not going to revolutionise anything. And if NEFET think it's slightly risky, then why don't we just listen to that advice? Sweeney makes the point in his piece, Eamonn Sweeney, it is disappointing the staying at 200 and not going to 500, but it's not a tragedy. And it may well be the right decision. Isn't that the key line? It may well be the right decision. Nobody knows for sure it's not. So maybe we should exercise caution here. Now, everybody is raising an eyebrow over the line that GAA fans travelling together and congregating at matches, you know, that they'd be getting together, travelling doesn't correspond with reality, but that's their line and they're sticking to it. And we should point out as well, it seemed that Micheál Martin was unaware until recently that the 200 person limit included players and management and officials, and Eamonn Sweeney writes, that added to the impression that the issue hadn't exactly been of paramount importance to those imposing the restrictions, and I get that as well, but it's difficult to criticise it at the same time when, as he says, the Gay Theatre has announced it's remaining closed until 2021. Theatres, concert halls, pubs all remain shut. Sport is not in a bad place in that games are happening. You know, a couple of weeks ago it was the mental health of the players, and now it's, oh, the 300 people who can't come to this match. I mean, you wonder if it's moved to 500, will sport be happy then, or will we be saying, can we not get this to 750?
Yeah, there is a little bit of frustration, and I like the picture in the Independent of Colm O'Rourke sitting in the stands, and you can understand this. So you're at a game and you're sitting in a stadium which holds 20,000, and there's 100 people in the stands.
Yeah.
And you're looking around, you can see how someone would be saying, surely this isn't the way it has to be, surely we can do a bit better than this. But the reality is that there's, whether it's the government or the National Public Health Emergency Team, whoever it is, I mean, they're trying to make the right decisions in a huge, huge national crisis, really, you know. So in some ways, we want everybody to be treated the same. And then in other ways, we're saying, no, we don't want to be treated the same. We're saying there's a difference between like a rural pub and Temple Bar. And when you lay it all out and you pick holes and you look at all the discrepancies, okay, you can see the problem. And Eamonn Sweeney mentioned something about, you know, it's not safe for 400 people to watch a match in Skibbereen outside, but in a couple of weeks time they're saying it'll be safe for 800 students to go back to the same school. So we can all see the discrepancy. But thinking about today, I was thinking, well, maybe the point is they're trying to make sure that we don't fall into the trap of thinking life is back to normal, because it's not back to normal, and we all still have to stay vigilant and do the right thing. So if normality just resumes, then maybe we'll all get a bit too slack. You know, maybe we need to keep those measures, and we need to keep reminding ourselves that life hasn't returned to normal. And I loved, like, I was reading Sweeney's piece in the start, I was sort of like, is this going to be another moaning one when we're just giving out about all these little injustices? But he wraps it up really well, as you were saying, that he talks about theatres and the arts, and which they're decimated, absolutely decimated. So the version of me in the arts, so somebody who supports actors, they have nothing to do. At least I now can go to my office, which is the sideline of a pitch. You know, even though there's only 100 people there, there's still something for me to do, yeah, rather than absolutely nothing.
Yeah, I'd agree. I think your point is very well made on the behavioural aspect of their thinking. Keeping it at 200 makes it very clear to everybody this is still a very dangerous situation and you need to monitor your behaviour. And secondly, 80% of people might behave very well. Anecdotally, I can tell you there's definitely 20% of people who aren't behaving well. So they'll go to matches and they won't socially distance. They'll be over talking. You know, I think... you're just seeing things. You're seeing things all the time. And I'm sure the government are saying, well, if we loosen it to 500, then we can't trust everyone to behave well. And, you know, that, but the behavioural point, I think, is dead right. It's a reminder that this is still such a volatile situation. Eamon Sweeney makes some other great points as well, you know, or just in broad terms and less about sport. But he talks about direct provision and how it constitutes a deliberately cruel attack on some of the most vulnerable people in this country, and it's a racist stain on our national character. Yet, even though it's been clear since March that direct provision endangers the lives and the health of those imprisoned within it, no NPHET official has ever suggested that the system should be closed down for the duration of the COVID-19 crisis, which is a startling and brilliant point. And he goes on to say, last week, four clusters in direct provision centres accounted for 47 new cases. NPHET has been quick to warn about the risks of house parties and to recommend restaurants be forced to close at 10:30, but appears to have no problems with the COVID black spot, which is the direct provision centre. Direct provision is apparently such an essential part of Irish life that it's above criticism, which I think was a point well made as well. And look, there are inconsistencies, you know, I mean... You see the picture of Pat Spillane and his family watching the match, and there's loads of space around them, and it, you know, there is more room there for sure. And as Eamon Sweeney points out, the government is serious about preventing a resurgence, but it's not entirely serious. If it was, we wouldn't be, as Social Democrats Joint Leader Roisin Shordal pointed out less than a month ago, the only EU country that allows American visitors to come in at the moment. Why are we so out of line with the rest of Europe? We're clearly engaged in high-risk behaviour. And Sweeney says there's never been any explanation of why this is the case, or why during the original outbreak we were alone among European countries, kept our borders entirely open. So, you know, there are inconsistencies everywhere for sure, but it's just the reality of this situation. It's inevitable. We seem to talk about this most weeks, and you know, it's tiring at this stage. Like, there's people playing sport, there's 200 people in allowed. Like, can we just enjoy that and just, you know, accept it for what it is at the moment?
There's also the point as well, Joe, that should be made quickly, that it's not difficult to understand why the GA has come out and tried to bat for itself a bit more. Like, I mean, I think we all agree that, yeah, a bit of caution is fine as well. But it's easy to understand why the GA are kind of pushing for a little bit more leeway from their purely selfish, and I mean that in a good way, point of view. And Mick Foley has a piece in the Sunday Times as well, picking up on something that's been a kind of a side of this whole issue that's been dealt with in the Examiner and the Times and other papers during the week, the financial aspect on the boards. There's no money coming in.
Yeah.
They're facing a situation where, as Mick puts it here, some of the chairman or chair people he's been talking to, wondering with genuine concern as county chairman whether their counties will be able to field teams at inter-county level at all. So from a financial point of view, I mean, this is just, you know, it's the worst possible scenario. You have no money coming in, and now you're faced with inter-county season coming up where money will fly out, as we know it does. I mean, even before COVID-19, that was a huge issue. So there are, as there are with all of us in every industry, there's huge financial concerns, which, although secondary to health and safety, they are huge concerns.
Yes, it's hard to know if there's enough money in GAA central coffers to bail out the county boards for this year at least.
Hard to know. I mean, Mick puts one of the figures he uses in his piece is television money represents roughly 11 million from Sky and RTE, and the reordered 2020 football championships, 20 odd games on TV is a reasonable result, and may earn around 4 to 5 million. So, where does that money go? I mean, the money is plowed back into the GA, but in what form? It's a shrinking pot, and everybody has their hands out with a bowl. So, you know, it's something I don't think maybe the general public or even the media has looked that far down the line because there's so much happening at the moment. But where does the money come from? I mean, a few of the questions that Mick puts here, I don't know if he's quoting somebody or I think it might be himself. I mean, what could teams do without? Do they need overnight hotels? Could team buses potentially create a cluster of cases? Can team meetings be reduced and scaled back to Zoom calls? Can players and management feed themselves? What are the possibilities around the 12-month moratorium on expenses? And what low-hanging fruit can be clipped from the backroom teams? I mean, the questions are endless. And once you start cutting, you know, you've health and safety down with players, you've expertise. It's very hard to roll things back once you have a certain level of cleaning. Will know this a lot better than me, a certain level of facilities and backup and everything else. I mean, it's a nightmare for people to even get their heads around that.
Yeah. Clean, I don't really know to what extent county boards are funded by the local championship matches and the crowds they bring in. Is that the main source of funding, would you suspect, around the country?
Well, that'll be a big source, you know, the whatever the county stadium is and championship matches. And it, without a doubt, it is a big source of funding. And like you're right, it's 100% a challenge. And there's going to be counties with a much smaller budget to have to work with for this upcoming inter-county season. Yeah. And the other point is true, that when you're used to operating in a certain level with certain facilities and certain standards and expectation and support teams and, as you mentioned, overnight hotels, depending on the game, all this sort of stuff, when you're used to operating at that level because you want to do everything right and be as professional as you can, and then you're faced with the choice, well, what bits do we cut out?
Yeah.
So if the motto is for the last number of years, whatever it takes and inches and we'll do everything we can, and then we're saying, well, if we can only do 50% of that, what 50% are we going to pick? The flip side of that is, though, it does force you to focus on what is actually essential and really important, and that is something that I personally have learned over the COVID period anyway. Like, what exactly, if I boil my role down to the essential elements, what is it? Do I need all the fancy equipment and the fancy pitch or whatever? Is a phone call enough sometimes?
Yeah.
So it forces you to focus on what's important, I think, in terms of preparing teams, because the money isn't there and won't be there.
Okay. Cliona O'Connor, Brendan O'Brien, back in a few moments' time.
The Sunday Papers on Off the Ball.
Welcome back. We're chatting through the Sunday Papers. We have Brendan O'Brien from the Irish Examiner. We have Cliona O'Connor, part of the Dublin Hurling coaching setup and an All-Ireland winner in her playing days as well in football. Page 2 of the Sunday Independent, Enigma of Boylan Goes Unexplained, is Tommy Conlon's piece. I didn't see the Sean Boylan documentary during the week called Sean. Either of you see it?
No, on record.
On record.
Just bits, Cliona? And pieces for me.
Bits and pieces. Okay. Well, then we're not very well placed to have this discussion. I'm sure we'll do our best anyway. So Tommy Conlon feels it was a missed opportunity. In short, unfortunately, the new documentary shown on RTÉ Thursday failed miserably to get to the heart of what he says is a key matter. How could such a nice man send out such brutish teams? He even says calling it simply Sean suggested this was going to be a cosy, sentimental affair. He was famous in those years, and most people referred to him as Boylan. It should have been changed to that name. He goes on to talk about, you know, Boylan being a palpably decent man, and yet he was responsible for teams which frequently were reviled for their lack of decency, and does not remember that period fondly, I think. Meath football from the late 1980s, he says, looking back in some of those games from the 80s now, it was dinosaur stuff, primitive and backward. The Kerry team of 75 to 86 elevated Gaelic football. When Meath took over as champions in 87, 88, it was like going back to the dark ages, and talks about Galway in 98 almost sweeping that type of football into the doldrums with their style and their flair, that Galway in 98 kind of signalled the end of all that. It was a flat-out rejection of the macho cynicism that had become normalised in Gaelic football. According to the grim worldview of the 80s he's talking about, the end justified the means. So as long as you won, it didn't matter how you did it. It wasn't about skill and creativity on the ball. It was about dominating your opponent psychologically and physically. And Tommy doesn't feel, Cliona, that we got a good explanation of that from the piece on Thursday.
From the sounds of it, and everything that has come out since, it's all about basically how wonderful Sean was and what a, or is, but was as a manager, I should say, and how the connection he had with his players, which you can't find a Meath player who doesn't back that up. And I suppose that the issue that Tommy raises is sort of, it's okay, the man off the pitch and the manager on the sideline, and how those two things don't compute. And there's a lovely bit in it where he's saying Boylan remained an enigma. His players could have inflicted assault and battery on the field, but in a post-match interview, this lovely man would appear and say lovely things about everyone. He was apparently oblivious to the cognitive dissonance between what his players were doing and what he was saying. And it's, in some ways it's a little bit funny, and in some ways, you know, he's painted as a herbalist and connected to the natural world, and maybe for him, like, the arena of football was some sort of primal thing where it's sort of anything goes, and off the pitch we'll look after you and we'll be lovely and we'll connect as human beings, but once we go on the pitch, it's an absolute battleground, and it is a whatever it takes, whatever you've got to do, and it's very, I suppose, the stereotypical masculine idea of competitive battle. And that seemed to be what he saw football as, in terms of the teams. I mean, the teams you churn out are a reflection of you, especially if you're with them for 23 years. It's not like he was with them for a season or something. Like, he produced a culture in Meath of that type of football.
I wonder, Brendan, though, to what extent that culture of football was operating in isolation, or to what extent was it just part of how you played GAA back then? I mean, we're putting it all on Meath's door. Were there not plenty of dirty teams around?
Yeah, and that's the phrase, it takes two to tango, definitely comes in at that stage, doesn't it? You also have to remember where Meath were coming from when Boylan took over. They were nowhere. You know, Meath were in the doldrums. They were, you know, who were Meath? I mean, they were a nobody in greater terms. I mean, you look at Leinster, Dublin had dominated the 70s, Offaly came in. Even a team like Laois was knocking around, had huge plans for a Leinster title. You know, Meath were nowhere. So, I mean, there would have been a chip on shoulders. This would have been a team that, let's not forget, had some savage players coming into it as well. So you do have to put all that into account as well. And this was an era when football was, you know, that mano a mano culture. It was a very different time. And I take Tommy's point about, you know, the Dubs about Kerry and a great shining light as well. But, I mean, crikey, we've all looked back at those TG4, you know, All-Ireland finals. And I mean, some of the stuff that went on in the 70s when Meath were nowhere to be seen was appalling. So, you know, it's of its time, but I think Tommy's whole point is a very, very good one. And like you say, Joe, none of us have seen the entire documentary, but I read Patrick Frayne, who's a TV critic in the Irish Times, and who says himself in a wonderful piece that he's not a GAA man, but his lament in his piece was that the documentary didn't go in more to his life as a herbalist and maybe the spiritual side of it, and how did that reflect or not reflect on his football career. So even from a guy who wasn't a GAA fan, he picked up on that here again was an unexplained side to Sean Boylan, the man. But I loved as well, I mean, Tommy's piece is on the bottom of page two, and above it is Colm O'Rourke's piece, which, as we dealt with earlier, is mostly about the situation of 200 and 500 limits. But Colm's last line on the piece, I think, feeds wonderfully into the Tommy Conlon. He says, he's talking about the Greek origins of the word hero, and he basically says, Sean Boylan is certainly a hero at home to all in Meath and probably everywhere else too. And then, of course, the next thing you do is you look down at Tommy Conlon's piece, and it's like, Colm, you really got that one wrong. I mean, Tommy just slates into, you know, what that Meath team was. And one of the things that catch your eye is this isn't just one guy looking back and saying, no, I never liked them, or I'm looking back now. Tommy actually uses the example of the late Paddy Downey, who was the Irish Times GAA correspondent for a long time. And he mentions a couple of games when Paddy picks out that, you know, Meath weren't exactly shining great light for Gaelic football at the time. You know, one, but not so alas for Gaelic football, he said, a great day for Meath. What was that one, 1984, 86? There's a couple of examples there. So it's not like I have a very vague memory. I was quite young in the late 80s. And speaking as somebody born in Leinster, you know, Meath were, it was never that they were dirty. It was just that they were Meath, that they were very good. I mean, you knew that they played on the edge, but you know, I don't have any great memories of them being, you know, by a country mile. Now, maybe I'm wrong in that. I was following football, soccer more closely at the time. But I think your point earlier on goes to the heart of it. They weren't alone in that. Mm. It was a very different culture in GAA at the time.
It was, yeah. How dirty were Mead? 53106, if you're another listener, you can let us know. Speaking of a different culture, over on page 3 then, interesting piece, Dermot Crowe here is speaking to David Price, who is the son of Johnny Price. And this goes back to an incident 35 years ago, 1985, very famous incident. And he's gone and spoken to David, son of Johnny, who was in the car with Johnny Price, Johnny being a referee in Wicklow. 1985, Blessington played Anacura in the Wicklow under 21B football final. And Price was forced into the boot of his car afterwards. It's a famous story. Confronted by an angry supporter of the losing team, Dermot Crowe writes, there was a version of the story that the referee had been driven away from the ground by the perpetrators, which did not happen. Price had sent off a player, and this was seemingly the reason for the unhappiness. And Dermot has gone and spoken to David, who is now 41 years of age. He was in the car. He says, my dad took it fairly light-hearted anyway. He would never really let anything get to him. I was in the car at the time. I didn't see anything. I just heard the bang, and I turned around and I locked the car. The keys were in the ignition. I didn't know what to do. I went along for the day because there was nobody to mind me. I was brought to most games at the time. Eventually, they got him out of the boot. I mean, it's just one of those bizarre stories, Cliona, that everyone's heard. Doesn't happen that often. To be fair, it didn't happen that often then either.
No, thankfully it didn't. I really enjoyed reading this because I remember hearing this story for the first time. I was in my own GA club and I said something about Wicklow, and the guy I was talking to said, sure, those fellas, mind yourself now, they throw referees into the boot of cars. And I was like, what are you talking about? And he told me the whole thing and how it was recounted to me. He was driven away somewhere and left in some wood or something, obviously, which we now know didn't happen. So it's one of these sort of fables of the GAA, and it's nice to actually see a picture of a son and see what actually happened. But sure, it's. I mean, you in some ways you say, I was about to say, is it some madness that used to go on, a bit like what we were saying about Sean Boylan, is it of its time? But thankfully, it is maybe a one instance that has just become part of GAA history. Obviously, nobody condones throwing referees into the boot of their car, regardless of any scenario. But it is nice, and I presume it was really nice for David to talk about his dad and to talk about that and recount it. But it was then later on in the piece, Kevin O'Brien, a Wicklow player, talks about the bad rap that he feels Wicklow have got for it. You know, the club scene and always having to account for the fact that they're vicious and what do they do to referees and their club rivalry is out of control and all of this. So he comes across that the Wicklow lads are always trying to defend themselves and they've got this legacy of having some brutish GAA culture. I don't know if that's true, but it definitely comes across from him, from his perception of it or his answers.
Yeah, he reckons we always felt in Wicklow the coverage would be stronger if there was an incident because it was Wicklow, give a dog a bad name, and then it was, they're at it again. So Meath have a crap reputation, Wicklow have a crap reputation. We're getting through most of the counties here at this stage. Anything jump out at you from it, Brendan?
Yeah, I think what I agree with Clean there. I just love reading it because, I mean, like you guys, this is a story that everybody heard, and it's only when I was reading the piece from Dermot Crowe that I was thinking, I know nothing about it. I don't know. I have a vague memory of reading a piece on it maybe 5 or 6 years ago. I don't know if it went into this detail, but I think it's lovely that his son is talking about it and just that it does clear it up. And I was just so happy to read that David's dad, it never seemed to have affected him.
No.
I mean, when you think of what happened, I mean, something like that could be so traumatic. And of course, we live in a time now where that would be dealt with by Crow Park, as it says in the piece. But there would be, you know, there would be services there for somebody who's gone through something so traumatic like that. And it would be dealt with much differently. But it was just so nice to hear that it didn't seem to knock a funk out of him, as the saying goes. It was just great to see. It was uplifting. Mm. And I was actually interested then about, you know, a third of the way through the piece, like Dermot had dealt with it and said, no, everything's fine. David was fine. His dad was fine. And I was looking at, it's a huge single page broadsheet. I was thinking, where does he go with the rest of the piece? Because you might think it would go into detail about how it had effects on the family or whatever. It didn't. So he expands it out a good bit, which was a very good way of doing it. Cleaner mentions Kevin O'Brien talking about the reputation and the bad stain that it would have given. And I remember when I started covering Club GAA and County GAA in the noughties, hearing about the Golden Glass Rathnew thing when Rathnew were at the tip of their powers as well. So even at that stage, that would have been 20 years on, there was still that undercurrent. And I remember the story with the referee in the boot would have been coming through. Mm. And just in terms of Dermot opening it out, like, he's spoken to other referees in it. So he's spoken to John Keenan, who was attacked 5 years ago. And he's got some, quotes about John Keenan talking about how he got a black eye, a badly bruised nose, there was nothing broken, it was a shock more than anything. And then Willie Barrett in Tipperary, when he abandoned the South Tip Championship match in Kilsheelan after a vicious assault from a supporter, he shipped blows from a hurl to the hand, the back and hip. So it's not an everyday occurrence, but it is something that has happened at times, and there has been this undercurrent up to the present day in GA of just a tinder, a spark there that can happen, that we've seen, mass brawls and pile-ups and stuff like that. So it is stuff that happens.
Yeah.
And I think it was very important that Dermot did give Wicklow kind of this right of reply, whatever it is, 35 years later. And even just a small line from Hugh Kenny, who's a former county player and manager, and he's now the Wicklow Games manager, saying that this year they recruited 17 new adult referees. And he says, if you look at other counties, that's a good return. So that's what it is. It's a right of reply to an incident 35 years later. I think it's a really important piece, and it's a lovely piece to show that this story that nearly kind of found its way into urban myth is brought to life, and brought to life in such a lovely way.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Page 3 of the Sunday Independent. I'd always heard the car was driven off as well and abandoned somewhere.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
I mean, it makes it a better story, doesn't it? Then they just left him there and he was taken out of the boot a few minutes later. But it's not ideal. His son was in the car. I mean, that's probably had the potential to be terrifying for the son.
Yes.
Thankfully, 6-7 years old then, he didn't seem to be too rattled by it. Turning to something totally different then, Cliona, I know you picked out this piece. It's on page 11 of the Sunday Independent. The Camogie Association have laid out their plans for the next 3 years, and they've taken the opportunity to write about them on page 11 of the Sunday Independent here. I wouldn't say you were blown away by the level of detail they provided. There are buzzwords aplenty, but actually I'm not too sure what's going to change between now and 2023.
Yeah, I was a little bit disappointed, and I mean, Sinead McNulty was head of sport in DIT, now TUD, and has now taken over as Arts Juror of the Camogie Association. No doubt a capable leader, but I was disappointed with the piece, because I was sort of saying, I kind of read it and I was like, I found myself saying, well, so what? Or obviously, you're saying that, the challenge for Camogie now is to raise the bar and be ambitious in our thinking and bring all our members with us, reaching for the goals and exceeding their expectations. And then a couple of paragraphs later, over the next 4 years, we intend to grow the recognition and popularity of Camogie. We plan to improve our media coverage, attendances and commercial growth. And I'm sort of saying, obviously. Mm. And I suppose it's a bit frustrating. And I think sometimes governing bodies, or especially if it's a smaller sport, and if we're honest about it, we talk about the GAA family, and Sinead mentions it in the piece. And so you got the GAA, the men's side of the house, you've got LGFN, you've got Camogie, and probably in many ways Camogie can be bottom of the pile in some areas in terms of coverage and funding and all those types of things. Not in terms of effort, but in some ways they are restricted. And I think sometimes when you're coming from that position, it's like we can't admit what's wrong, or we can't sort of give detail, and we talk in this language where it's all positive and we're going to aspire and we're going to overcome challenges. But I'm always left saying, well, what does that actually mean? How are you going to do it? What are the big problems of Camogie, and what are the actions? Mm. And the final line is, or the final paragraph, there's so many opportunities on and off the field to grow Camogie. I agree with that. The plan is all about aspiration and teamwork, great, wonderful core values of the association. Always want to be better and working together to achieve that goal. So now is the time to get involved. And if I'm sitting on the sideline and I'm reading this and I'm saying, well, none of that makes me want to get involved, because I'm no more knowledgeable than I was 15 minutes ago when I started reading the piece. Mm. And I don't know, I think sometimes we need to be more honest or just say it how it is. These are the issues and this is what we're going to try and do to fix it. These are the problems we have. And just be kind of a little bit more blunt about it, I think.
Yeah, it's very abstract, buzzwordy. The key messages of the new plan are passion, people, pride and place. And then later on, we target four key pillars within the new plan: the game, the volunteers, identity, leadership. I don't even know what does targeting identity mean? Like,
Yeah.
And she's absolutely, I'm sure, very, very, very capable. And maybe the plan is very specific and Sinead didn't feel this was the place to detail the specifics of that plan.
Yeah.
At the same time, if in 3-4 years we were to bring out this piece and judge the progress of the association by the aims in this piece, we wouldn't be able to do that because I don't know what a single aim is really in real terms. You know, is it like she doesn't talk about where Camogie is and isn't played and what they want to do specifically about that. As you said, there's no maybe blunt outlining of what the problem is and what we're going to do about it.
Yeah. I think if you're in a position like that and you want people to buy into your association, your vision, respect it, my personal view is the best way to do that is kind of back yourself and say, this specifically is what we're going to attack and this is how we're going to do it. And nearly call yourself out or throw the gauntlet down to yourself. I find when people talk like this, I find it frustrating because I find, well, I don't know what any of that means.
Brendan?
Yeah, what strikes me about it is it's a difficult medium for somebody like a CEO to get right. It reads to me like something you would see on a strategic plan. So the introduction for a strategic plan from the CEO. I mean, the very first line reads like that. This has been an unprecedented year for us all. The whole format of it just strikes me like that you would flick open the big book. And here's the introduction from the CEO. Here's the chairperson of the board. And it's literally a blank page that's been given to a CEO. And there's an understandable urge to include everything in it. It is very vague. And I think a lot of newspapers give people, whether it's CEOs or people in a certain profession, when a certain news event has happened, they will give them a blank page. Could you write about this? Some people are very good at that and they will get to the nub of, like Cliona says, what is the most important or critical task facing us as an organization now? Others, like in this example, it is a bit too vague and it doesn't really explain, you know, what are the challenges facing them. So it's, for me, it's an imperfect way of getting your message across. You know, journalists aren't perfect, but there's a training and an understanding there that you need to get a hook. You need to get you know, a very clear focus on what it is you're writing. You need to write on one subject really well rather than a lot of subjects and not say much at all. So it's I've seen plenty of these down the years. Some of them do work, but it is a very, very hard thing to get right.
Yeah, no, I'm sure it is. A few texts in on different things we've been talking about. On the Sean Boylan piece, I've rarely felt the urge to write to an editor about a sports piece before, but I might this time. There was no effort at context or to say something beyond the usual stereotypes of Meath football in Tommy Conlon's piece. Though Keith in Ashburn says, ah, come on, lads, the nostalgia's clouding your memories. Meath certainly did rely on the dark arts more than most, is his point. And Mike in Donegal, why do the GAA think they should be allowed spectators? They are amateurs. The players are not paid. The League of Ireland are playing behind closed doors and they pay their players. GAA cop on. It is a fair point. I haven't heard a squeak from the League of Ireland about the lack of fans, and yet I would say it's been in the Sunday papers every week for the last 2 months. And the League of Ireland, there's no one campaigning on their behalf to get some fans in the doors, 200 fans or otherwise. And I would say there's probably season ticket holders desperate to get in and support League of Ireland teams. So we'll leave the piece in the Camogie Association. It might be something we follow up on and see if we can get a bit more detail and invite Sinead McNulty on. She can chat about where Camogie is and where it needs to go. Where do you want to go next? So, I mean, there's a few different things. I hasten to say this. There's FAI, which I think people have had their fill of, but we should touch on the coverage in the papers. There's Eric Donovan, GAA players retiring, Rory McIlroy. Cliona, anything grab you want to jump off on?
I suppose that there's a bit on in the, sorry, I'm just getting it there in front of me, in the Sunday Times. There's a nice piece with Eric Donovan. He's talking about his, I suppose, his boxing, his career, or problems with his career, his mental health, where he's at now. In some ways it's a familiar story, Joe. We've heard it from sports people before, the challenges. It seemed like he really had a tough time. You know, he was everything was going great for him. There's a bit here in the middle by, this is Michael Foley piece. By 2012, he was near his peak and broke his hand at a house party, with life beyond the gym spiraling out of control. Boxing had become the source of his entire self-worth. The relationship became toxic. And then he's quoted as saying, boxing just became baggage. I was abusing myself. I was boxing so I could hold on to some integrity, because I'd lost all my integrity outside the ring. Boxing became my sole route to happiness. Outside the ring, I wasn't happy or in a good place. I was self-destructing. I hated boxing for that. Every conversation I had in my life was about boxing. All the stuff I was doing outside the ring as well. It was a vicious circle. And it's I suppose that conflict within athletes, and I think there's another piece you might talk about in terms of GAA players retiring, that whatever their sport is, being so part of, so much integral to their identity. And that can be wonderful, because it gives people a sense of identity if they're struggling elsewhere. But then there can be resentment too if it's not going well. And the way he talked about it really came across, and like you could feel that bit of anguish in the whole piece. And now he's talking about later on, and he's sort of rekindling his career and his professional career in boxing. And he talks about his relationship with Kenneth Egan. And it was a really nice quote. Well, I found it lovely and I found it sad at the same time. He's saying, we stood on podiums at European Championships together in 2010. We stood on top of bar counters. We fell under bar counters together. And here we are, two buddies fighting the good fight in life. And it epitomized that sort of relationship of someone you've been in the trenches with. And in some ways, it's lovely that they've still got a great relationship and they've been through the mill together. But there was a little bit of sadness in it too, the fellas who'd seen each other in the best and the worst possible times too.
Yeah. So the reason for this is that Eric Donovan's fighting on Friday night. We had him on the show last week, and he's a brilliant person, Eric Donovan, and speaks with such depth and self-awareness, I always find. So he's fighting Zelfa Barrett from Manchester. And Donovan really is being brought over to be beaten. You know, he's the B side of this from the Sky Sports Eddie Hearn point of view. Zelfa Barrett is somebody they feel can be a big star in Manchester, and this will be a high profile fight for him. And so they needed somebody, and they brought over Donovan. And Eric feels he's a real chance here. And Tony Bellew said the same thing. He was surprised that you'd bring over such a risky B side, as it's called, to fight Barrett. But they've gone for Eric Donovan, and we wish him well. The thing that jumps out at you, Brendan, is that Eric feels he wasted his amateur career and his amateur talent, and there's no doubt he was seriously talented as an amateur and didn't fulfill his potential for various reasons. He was going through difficult things personally, and he says himself, the reason I turned professional was I had too many regrets. I couldn't sleep. I didn't have peace of mind. It was always a case of, what if I had done this? What if I had done that? So even though he's 34, 35 now, you do feel, quite honestly, from his point of view, the next year or two is going to have a big say in how he feels over the next 30, 40 years about his innings.
Absolutely, yeah. And just one of the lines that's mentioned in there, that he missed out on the chance to go to the Olympics because he broke his hand at a house party.
Yeah.
So this is a guy who has, as he says himself, he's dealing with dark mental health addiction. So I've no doubt, Eric has said before, he's made a lot of mistakes in his life. You boil it down to that one mistake. You missed the Olympics, not because you broke your hand in a sparring session or in a fight, or because you slipped down the stairs. You were at a house party. Now, regardless of the rights or wrongs of it, he was an elite athlete at the time, and I'm sure he'd look back and say, should I have been at that house party? Should I have been concentrating on my career a bit more? That one regret that you would have, that you would miss an Olympics for something as innocuous as that, and a mistake that might have been so easy not to make, I mean, that alone would, you know, hang over people for a long time. I've spoken to a few athletes from past Olympic Games, stretching back to the 76 Games in Montreal in the last couple of months, and there are regrets there going back to 1976. People don't get over these things. they do and they don't. They compartmentalize and they learn to live with them better. So this is a guy, as you said, Joe, and as Kleena said, who's dealing with a lot of baggage back in the day. He said he's had his ups and downs since. He's made a very admirable attempt to get back on the right path in life. And you just love to see him go out there in Eddie Hearn's back garden and do something wonderful as well. Mm. And there's a point in it as well where he talks about, it's kind of nearly a throwaway line in it, but it fits in well with the other pieces that touch on mental health in today's papers, where, you know, even in school, you were kind of discouraged by your buddies, because what's the point in doing well at school? If you do well in school, you'd be asked to do more.
Yeah.
And there's that kind of, that fits in as well with the GPA piece, or the Gaelic, the GAA piece about, you know, how sport can take over our lives and how with people who are at the elite end of it, it can become their be all and end all, as Kleena says. And that again ties, and that's unusual for a GAA sense as well, because I suppose I would have always taken for granted that down the years, even in interviews, you would talk to GAA players, and because they're amateurs and because they live in the community, there was always this perception, maybe on my end certainly, that they would be better able to deal with whatever regrets they had or transitioning out of the dressing room, because they were more tight-knit with their community, that they were, you know, they had jobs to go back to. But it's not always that way. And with Eric, again, it shows it's a very fine line. How much of yourself do you give to your sport? How much of your identity do you give over to it? And there's the other piece that we might touch on, Rory McIlroy. It's a quote at the end of it where he said before, I've lots of other things where I enjoy in my life now. And people have and will criticise Rory McIlroy for that and say he lacks the laser-like focus of a Brooks Koepka in the majors or a Tiger Woods at his best or whatever, which is the healthier approach, you know. So it's amazing how you can read three different pieces on three different sports in two different papers and they can all tie together.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, the McIlroy one is always interesting. I never think with him, I mean, he talks about this balance all the time. I don't think it's mutually exclusive. Like, I think you can have incredible balance as a golfer and still be winning majors. Like, I think Brooks Koepka looks on golf generally with a sense of disdain. I think he's actually, I think he's embarrassed he's a golfer, you know. I really do. I don't think he walks around going, I'm a golfer and that's all I am. I think he's like, oh my God, I can't believe I've become a professional golfer, you know, against my better judgment. But where McIlroy was just stunningly brilliant, and Rick Broadbent touches on it, is in the second round, where an ESPN reporter stood on his ball accidentally up around the green, and so they had to try and replace the ball to its previous lie, and they'd put it on a decent lie, still a bad lie, lots of thick grass around and still a tough shot, and McIlroy was uncomfortable taking that lie because he felt that, well, I can see this ball with this new lie, and clearly if it had been that visible, the ESPN reporter wouldn't have stood in it. So he said he just wasn't that comfortable, and he nestled it down more into this horrible thick rough, and then he tries to hit the shot and he makes his bogey. And he says here in Broadbent's piece, I just wouldn't have felt comfortable. The rule is to try and replicate the lie. And no one really knew what the lie was, but if everyone is going around looking for it, then obviously it wasn't good. I placed it and I was like, that doesn't look right to me. At the end of the day, golf is a game of integrity, and I never try to get away with anything out there. I'd rather be on the wrong end of the rules than on the right end, because as golfers, that's what we believe. And in the context maybe of a Bryson DeChambeau over the last few weeks, who has been, you know, arguably breaking the spirit of the rules to get any small advantage, and maybe he is so wrapped up and his identity is too much wrapped up in success. I thought, Kleena, that was incredibly admirable on McIlroy's part, that he could somehow separate, I'm sure, this massive desire to win a first major in 6 years with him as a human, you know, his own standing as a person and how he wants to be remembered. It was just a brilliant moment at a key moment in the tournament for him.
It says a lot about Rory, I think, as you said. He's, some people criticise him, some people think he's great, and maybe when you are so good for a period of time, you're always measured against that. Like, he's still a brilliant golfer, even though he hasn't won a major in a while now. But and it does, and especially when there's you're talking about other golfers who are pushing the rules and all that. So maybe it was important to him to remind people, no, this is how golf should be played.
I think that's part of what he was doing. I think he was sending DeChambeau a message. Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah. Which is, and if he loves his game and is committed to his game, well, then maybe that's a really important thing. Maybe that means more to him. He's a bigger picture. The last two paragraphs of that article, it just, after reading the Donovan one, reading the GAA one, and then reading this one, and it was, you know, Rory talking about this holistic sense of, as Brendan referenced already, I enjoy other things, I don't get bogged down as much by golf. He said last week he compared himself to 5 years ago, there are other things that give me joy now. And then Rick Broadbent finishes by saying, and so there should be, but he needs to concentrate and eradicate careless errors if he's going to go well today and again in the Masters in November, when he'll be tilting at the career Grand Slam. So it just reminded me of, we're all saying, oh yes, you definitely need a balance, yeah, and absolutely, and there are more important things in sport, but stop making mistakes. Mm-hmm. You know, it was a little bit of a kind of a cutthroat finish to it, and I suppose that's when you are an elite sports person, that's part of it. You've got to execute under pressure, and sometimes if you change your mindset, maybe you're not able to execute under pressure if you're not as focused. And part of the winning mentality is you do absolutely everything it takes, and it is the utmost priority in terms of your performance. That is the utmost priority, and everything revolves around that. And maybe that's what it takes to win and win and win. And if you change that for the good of the rest of your life, will you know you're taking the edge off your sports performance?
Do you think that it's inevitable that you will take the edge off your sport? Because I guarantee you, if McIlroy was winning and he was still talking about enjoying other aspects of his life, we would all be sitting around saying, well, he's clearly winning because he's not obsessed by the game and he's enjoying other aspects of his life.
Yeah. I think it depends on the individual, to be honest. I think some people, who's a really good example, Thomas Barr, when he runs, he looks like he is having a fantastic time. He's enjoying himself. Usain Bolt, same idea. So they've figured out whatever they need to do in terms of producing good performances. Some people can take things lightly, and some people, Breege Corkery, the wonderful Cork dual player, tells stories of when she was a younger player, the night before a game, she'd go for a pint. And the teammates would be giving out about it. And she said, and as she got older, she's like, well, probably shouldn't do this anymore. It probably looks bad. But she used to go out and have the game of her life. You know, so some people take things very, very lightly and see it in a bigger picture. And other people, and that gets the best out of them, and other people, they need to feel like, I am uber prepared and I have done absolutely everything and this is it and this means everything to me, and that produces their best performance. So you can't really say what's right for everybody, I don't think. But there is a cost if you are prioritizing your sport and you're an elite athlete and it's a choice and you're choosing to do so. It can cost in other areas, and that is the reality. It's like you're running a massive company. And you hear all the time men and women running massive companies, whatever their business demands are, and they're like, geez, I wish I was home more with my kids, or whatever the case may be. So anything that is out of the ordinary in sport or business or life, and other things suffer, and sports the same.
No, it's probably true, isn't it? That phrase, you know, with a successful life, you need to start with what you're willing to give up. And that's probably true of sports people. We'll take a short break. Final few stories with Brendan O'Brien and Cliona O'Connor in just a moment.
The Sunday Papers on Off the Ball.
Welcome back. We have Cliona O'Connor and Brendan O'Brien reviewing the Sunday Papers. FAI features. It's been a messy week for the FAI. So there's Mark Tighe and Paul Roan, page 6 of the Sunday Times main section, and page 67 of the Mail on Sunday as well. Philip Quinn is writing about it, for instance. I mean, in short, there's been the bailout. We know about the bailout, and the FAI need to officially ratify the terms of agreement around that bailout. They need a two-thirds majority when they have an EGM later this month. And this week it all kicked off as very messy when 8 directors issued a statement saying, well, they never even signed off on this agreement with the FAI in the first place. And since then, Roy Barrett has argued back that they did and they were aware of it. And in the end, on Friday evening, Roy Barrett, who's the chairman, met with the FAI council. They have about 79 members and tried to assuage them of all their various fears, including this 6-6 balance on the board. There's a quote from Niamh Brennan, by the way, corporate governance expert at UCD, in the Sunday Times piece. And she says, you know, under the circumstances, 6-6 is perfectly acceptable from a corporate governance point of view. No other sporting organisation is relying on the taxpayer for €36 million. So it's just unfortunate the issue has become polarised. And that has probably not been talked about enough, because certainly the 8 board members said there's no other organisation in the world that has a 6-6 split. It should be 8 of ours and 4 independents. I mean, the point is, €36 million euro in taxpayers' money is on the line. Although over in Philip Quinn's piece, there's a quote from Mick Wallace, who's part of this FAI council as well. And he's kind of saying really that the FAI could have called the government's bluff on this, frankly. He says, this is the same government that bailed out useless broke banks for billions, and they're prepared to let the FAI go insolvent for a couple of million. They're going to lose €1 billion on the children's hospital. The idea that they'd let the FAI go insolvent because we couldn't agree to 6-6. There's close to 500,000 people registered to play football in Ireland, and they'd let it all go down the drain. I don't think they'd allow it go insolvent. So that's his take on things. We're going to find out at the end of the month what the EGM will do. There is an overall sense, Cliona, from the two pieces, that the meeting that Roy Barrett had with the FAI council on Friday evening at the Red Cow Hotel, although as one person there said to Philip Quinn, it's more like the Mad Cow Hotel this evening. But there is a sense that this has calmed things right down. There's been a bit of coolant put in the whole thing. There was a press conference afterwards where there was something approaching a united front between Roy Barrett and these 8 directors. And this whole deal now is likely to pass at the end of the month. So it's been wobbly and messy and probably embarrassing. And I'd say for most members of the public, a rolling of the eyes, but it's calmed down a bit now is where we are.
That does seem to be coming across today. That, and I think you're probably right, Joe, when you're saying what you're dealing with now are people on both sides. You can see it in every interview, everything you read. Like, there are people who are very passionate about Irish football, and they are probably embarrassed about the he said, she said, infighting stuff that's going on, and they understand this, why there's a distrust. I mean, they're talking about a rebranding, so they understand what people think when they talk, when someone says the FAI, and they're all trying to move by that. And I guess when you're coming from an era where voices weren't heard and people were silenced, and once you remove that, now everybody has loads of ideas and everybody has an opinion, and all of a sudden there's a vacuum. So everybody wants to put their viewpoint forward and fight for what they think is right because they're passionate. And like, it would, for the sake of the sport, because you're right, there's a lot of people playing. There's just a lot of participation in soccer. It means a massive sport in Ireland. Mm. And, you know, new management teams with international teams. So potentially Irish soccer could get a whole lot better, and changes with League of Ireland and all the stuff that's been happening with streaming. But as long as this infighting, let's call it, continues, it's going to overshadow everything. And it seems like that those people involved, all the various stakeholders in it, have kind of said, right, it's time now that we find a way to move this forward, because the longer it goes on, the more they're just holding it in the past. So you can't talk about rebranding and then keep fighting with each other. You definitely lose people then.
Yeah. Brendan Cleaner talked there about a vacuum. In the midst of that vacuum, what's going on here on all sides really is some effect at a power grab. Who can control the future destiny of the FAI?
Yeah, the whole week was about power. And the problem here is that it's not as black and white as it was. You can't just say this is, you know, the old guard under Delaney against, you know, the reformists.
No, and sorry to interrupt. I've heard that in places over the last couple of days, and that's not true. Even in the Mark Tye, Paul Rowan piece, they point out that the 8 elected board members, they are viewed as critics of Delaney's leadership. Even Paul Cook, he was banned from FAI annual meetings for raising questions about finances. So this isn't the 8 lads who were Delaney's men or Delaney's group trying to hang on.
No, very, very much not. And that's one of the problems with it. It's not a black and white issue in that regard, but it is about power and who wields it. And that's always been the problem with the FAI, certainly going back to even before John Delaney's time. And the question now is, I mean, there's interesting stuff in the papers today. The Mark Tighe and Paul Rowan piece has some interesting nitbits on what happened last week and meetings and phone calls. You know, there's an interesting uncredited quote from an unnamed source, a director, talking about, we always maintained that the 6-6 condition on the board was presented to us as a fail accompli. Gary made us out to be lying. Gary Owens, the interim CEO. I mean, that's, so this is 2 days after this council meeting that supposedly smoothed everything open, and you've a fairly thorny quote like that in it. And the question has to be asked now is, what are the ramifications of this week for the next coming weeks? In other words, the EGM on the 31st, we have the Nixon Morton thing about the legal challenge that the AGM should come before the EGM. It's still messy. And you mentioned there, Joe, Dr. Brennan from UCD, who's quoted in the piece in the Times. She was on another radio station earlier during the week where she called the current board dysfunctional.
Right.
And she questioned, now dysfunctional is a word we've heard with the FAI, the old Olympic Council. There's a piece in the Sunday World from Sean McGoldrick today about board issues in the IABA, the boxing body as well. It's a word we've heard far too often. And when I heard Dr. Brennan mention that word during the week, it just, out of all the stuff I've listened to this week, and I covered the FAI quite a lot this week, that's the one phrase that stood out to me as an alarm bell. She basically said, dysfunctional going forward. How can a board that is basically split in two, and that's a problem now. You have the 8 elected board members from within the so-called football family, seems to be against the 4 independents as it is. Mm. You will have 6-6 going forward, which basically means 2 of the elected from football fraternity will lose out to 2 more independents. Niall Quinn, who is the interim CEO, deputy interim CEO at the moment, he's tearing his hair out at this 6-6 narrative. He says it's 6+6, but when you have an expert in corporate governance like Dr. Brennan saying this is dysfunctional and how does this operate going forward, we are not in any shape or form out of the woods with this yet. The ramifications of this week, regardless of whether this reform package and memorandum of understanding gets voted in, we don't know where it's going to lead yet. There are serious issues to be addressed at the highest levels in the FAI.
Yeah, I think, Cliona, people are fed up with this 6-6 split or 8-4 split. And the general opinion would be, well, why would you be pitched against each other so evenly and on such firm lines over various issues where in the main you should all have pretty similar views on what's best? You know, you might have one or two dissenting voices or different thoughts, but in the main, you would think on most issues it should be pretty obvious what's in the best for Irish football. The fact that this is how they're viewing the makeup of the board, so yeah, like if it's going to be that acrimonious, I think people will have no time for it and will look at a board behaving like that as just acting in its own self-interest at all times.
I think there's a real danger of that because, well, I suppose it comes down to human nature, Joe, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And you mentioned power grab, and everybody is going to have their idea of how things are done right, and people who are now landed in decision-making positions, there's going to be a queue of people, no, this is what you should do and this is what you should do. And when you're trying to negotiate, and this isn't an excuse or anything, but it's reality. When you're in those leadership positions and you're trying to negotiate with the government and figure out how you're going to move this all forward, and then you have the democracy of a governing body and all the representations from various levels of the association, like it's and things happening in a short space of time, it's yeah, really challenging. And but that's the problem from an outsider. So I have no inside knowledge or of the FAI or soccer or anything like that. But from an outsider, I'm like, God, lads, if you can't get this piece right, where, as you say, where is it all going? Do you know what I mean? And this, surely, if you have a big task to move the FAI forward, and to it's in its 100th birthday next year, and if you can't figure out, or if you're still fighting over 6-6 versus 8-4, and as you rightly said, then it doesn't leave you with a lot of faith in this particular group being able to manage it if they can't get over the first couple of hurdles.
No, and you know, Philip Quinn points out, Brendan, that one of the points Roy Barrett made, and it was made during the week as well. So, like, there's this obsession now with 6-6, and like, who at the start of the week, none of us were, now we're talking about it like we're experts, and it's such a key issue. And Barrett pointed out really that the position of the chairman, who the 8 directors feel would have the casting vote, and in that case it'd be Barrett, and so really it's 7-6, and we're on the losing side. That was pointed out, that the position of the chairman holding the casting vote, that is not an MOU term agreed with the government. That is not locked in stone. That can be changed, you know? So, you know, this notion that you'll have the casting vote and we won't get our way anymore, and this is almost, you're privatizing the FAI, you're taking over. He's pointed out, this is not an MOU. So can we please just get the money, not go insolvent, and get things moving? I think from the outside, that looks like a fairly rational plan of attack.
Yeah.
The other thing, if you're covering this, then a bit like me, anytime you talk to anyone about this, you get what's in the public domain, and then you get the, well, come here, and you know what your man did, and you know what he did 6 months ago, and you know what they're actually doing here. Like, there is so much briefing against the other team at the moment.
Well, that's the thing with the FAI. I mean, the one thing you can say for John Delaney is he got everybody not speaking off the same page.
Yeah.
Nobody said anything. Everybody was subservient to the great man in the great big office. But prior to that, and for many years, factionalism was a cancer in the FAI. You had the clubs against the schools, leagues, the districts. It was a mess. And it wasn't the only NGV with that issue. I can think of a few more that still do. But factionalism was a huge issue, and it still is. I mean, you mentioned the board itself, a proper functioning board. If you're a member of, say, the school's body, or you're a member of, if you're a representative of the League of Ireland, and you're on that board, a proper board works by you taking off that hat and seeing everything in a wider picture. And that just doesn't happen in a dysfunctional board. So I was at the meeting on Wednesday, the media briefing, where Gary Owens and Niall Quinn spent, I would say, up to 3 hours briefing the broadcast, the online, and the print media. And it was towards the end of the print media, the one I was sitting in, where the question was asked about Roy Barrett, the independent chairman, and who has the casting vote on the board. And Gary Owens says, well, that could be changed at any time. And that was the kind of like a revelation within all this intrigue and everything else. And I walked out of that meeting thinking, like you just said, that's huge.
Yeah.
I mean, that cuts through everything. And yes. I walked out thinking, that is going to get this over the line. And then everything stumbled out, and it was he said, she said, what about the MOU? And it was like they took a step forward and then 2 steps back. But that's the fundamental issue in it. Even with, if the casting vote goes back to the president, which was the case prior to this year, okay, the control is back in the hands of the so-called football fraternity. But what Dr. Brennan said about the divisions in the board, the divisions in the FAI itself, whether it's board, council, club, league, everything, there's still an awful lot that has to be changed to get right. But the priority at the moment is, do they have the 2/3 majority to get this reform and memorandum of understanding through at the end of the month in the AGM?
Yeah. On that note, we'll have to leave it. We're right out of time. We had planned to touch on potentially a new job at World Rugby for Joe Schmidt. There was a piece on the scientific approach in the RFU, tennis facility at UCD, basketball story. Paul Kimmage talking about amazing, horrible crash this week in Tour of Poland and the ramifications for those involved. So they're all there and waiting for you, along with all the other good pieces across the papers today. Brendan O'Brien from the Irish Examiner, Cliona O'Connor with the Dublin Hurlers and former player as well with the footballers. Thanks so much. Appreciate it.
Thanks, guys. You.
The Sunday Papers on Off the Ball.
The OTB Podcast Network with Virgin Media. Catch all of the UEFA Champions League and Europa League games live on Virgin Media TV.